Romance is in the air. Sparks are flying. The chemistry is palpable. He comes from means. She comes from nothing. He is known and respected. She is a nobody. He is in his home country. She is a foreigner from another country. Their romance is unexpected and brings joy to literally millions. I don't care about no royal wedding. Talking about Ruth and Boaz. I don't care about that. No. Ruth and Boaz. That's pretty good though, right? That's pretty good. I've been promising you guys romance for 2 weeks now, right? With the big introduction of the love story. It now kicks off. And you've probably seen little bits of it coming down the road. Like you've seen when he says, oh, who is that in the field? Right? And the way that she responds to him. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you see the chemistry coming, and you're like, oh, I know it's inevitable. It's going to happen at some point. It's like, Han and Leia, or Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan and Everything, or Ross and Rachel, that's your brew, or Jim and Pam, maybe. How about Mike and Eleven from Stranger Things? Anybody in the house know what I'm talking? Yeah. It's like, you know it's going to happen eventually. Well, today, this morning, is when it's going to happen. We're going to get there. There's going to be the DTR, the define the relationship, today. Before we get there, we have to review. This whole thing started 2 weeks ago. By the way, we're in a series called The Best Is Yet to Come. You know what? Before I go any further, I'm getting ahead of myself. I like my opening so much that I'm skipping stuff. I'm supposed to say that 6 weeks ago, we did this thing where we painted on Easter, and the paintings ended up awesome. And that's the one sort of like fundraiser aspect of today's HSM Takeover is we're silent auctioning the paintings off in the cafe. If you're interested in those, they're out there, they're available, and they're awesome. You probably shouldn't go out there, because I would like to, and if you guys start bidding, it'll go up too high for me. So just never mind what I said. They're not as awesome as I said they are. No, but anyway. So we're in a series called The Best Is Yet to Come, and it's on the book of Ruth. It's 4 weeks on the four chapters, the 85 verses in the book of Ruth. And so we started 2 weeks ago, and it started with Elimelech, who took his family from his country of Bethlehem, and he takes it to the country of Moab. And shortly thereafter, three very powerful words happened, and Elimelech died. And that started a long process of painful things, unexpected things, things that happen in the story like they happen in real life with no explanation. And so it left us as the audience, but the people in the story wondering why. Why, God? Why would this happen? Why did you allow these things to happen the way that they happened? And that's exactly how life works, is when painful things happen, there's never explanation, there's never a voice from God. But what we did see in the first week is that a couple things allowed us to see that God was still moving, he was still active. Number one, that when Naomi was leaving for Bethlehem, that Ruth went with her. And what she said was so important. She says, your people be my people, where you go, I will go, your God will be my God. So even in that painful experience, Ruth came to the faith in the God of the Bible. And the second thing I would say that we saw that God was present was that they arrived in Bethlehem at the time of the barley harvest, which if you're here last week, you saw that was so important to their future, that they arrived at barley harvest season, which meant that they had a chance for hope, they had a chance for food, they weren't going to starve to death, which is very, very important. Last week, we saw that Boaz, whose field, she walked into Boaz's field, and Boaz took very good care of her. He was very generous with her. He shared lots and lots of grain with her, and he showed her this word that we talked about last week. Those of you in the front row are brave, because you knew this was coming. I see people holding up. It's this word, chesed. And when I say that word, I spit. So front row people have to be careful. And Boaz had chesed for Ruth. And it's this thing that you experience from God. Chesed is not love. It's not kindness. It's not grace. It's not mercy. It's not forgiveness. But it's the substance of your soul that causes you to be that. And when you experience God's chesed, it makes you a person of chesed. And then after you show chesed to the world, he shows you more. And it's like this constant cycle of being changed and changing and being more generous and more self-sacrificial. Which brings us to today, which brings us last week and this week, 3 months have passed. The last little verse in Ruth 2 says it's that Ruth worked in Boaz's fields for the next 3 or so months. And so now, so we've left there, he's very kind to her, he shows her chesed, and then 3 months pass. 3 months of just working hard, day in, day out, gleaning barley and wheat in the field, and we get to Ruth chapter 3. We're going to pick up in verse 1. So Ruth 3, verse 1. By the way, if you don't have a Bible, there are Bibles in the back. If you would like to take one, that's our gift to you. If you don't own a Bible, I'm now asking you, take one on your way out. We want you to own one, so take one of those. Ruth 3, 1 says this. One day, Naomi said to Ruth, "My daughter, it's time that I found you a permanent home for you, so that you will be provided for. Boaz is a close relative of ours, and he's been very kind by letting you gather grain with his young women. Tonight, he'll be winnowing barley at the threshing floor." Let me stop right there a second. So the threshing floor, this is like very loaded verbiage because on the threshing floor, what happens is all season long for the last several months, they are harvesting grain and barley. And like I said last week, is they're cutting it down and they're gathering it together in like bundles and they're setting those bundles aside. And they don't thresh it right away because if a thief comes in and takes a bundle, or a thief comes in and takes a basket of seeds, there's way more product in the basket of seeds than there is a bundle. And so keeping it in the bundles and threshing it all together all at once was like theft deterrent. And so they would thresh it all at once to get the seeds, the grains of barley out of the stalks. And so this all happened all at once on the threshing floor. And so what happened was this was the payday. This was the financial windfall. They've worked for a year, and they've harvested, you know, they've planted, they've watered, they've put fertilizer down, and this is the moment when there is like a windfall, when financially they get to reap what they've been sowing, quite literally, for the last year. But what you maybe don't understand is that the threshing floor is where the party is located. Because what you have lots of like rough around the edges, blue collar folks, and they now have money to burn in their pocket and they haven't for a very long time. So the threshing floor is kind of like a combination of like a Mardi Gras and a farm fair kind of rolled into one. You know, you have people who are, they're excited, they have money to burn, they've been working hard, and it is go time. Like, and so they're actually, what they do is they harvest, they thresh it, and then they sleep next to it so that no thieves can steal before they can take it to market and sell it. And so they are excited, they are partying. The threshing floor is not a place you'd want to send a respectable young person. So just so you know, she's like, Boaz, and he's the landowner, so he's definitely going to be there protecting it. So he says he's there on the threshing floor. This is like the pregame and the party and the after party all rolled into one on the threshing floor. Okay. "Now do as I tell you," Naomi says to Ruth. "Take a bath, put on perfume." I don't like where this is going already. "Dress in your nicest clothes, then go to the threshing floor." And at this point, you're like, huh, Naomi, that's funny advice. Why would you tell Ruth to go there? That's where the place you'd want her to not go. I'm not sure, Naomi, but we'll keep reading. Maybe, you know, we'll assume the best. Maybe she doesn't know what she's saying. "Then go to the threshing floor. But don't let Boaz see you until he has finished eating and drinking." Okay, I don't like where this is going. "Be sure to notice where he lies down." See, this is really not going well. "Then go and uncover his feet and lie down there." I think we should just close in prayer now. What do you guys think? "He will tell you what to do." Oh, come on, Naomi. This is not good advice, Naomi. Okay, he's at the threshing floor. He's been, you know, wait till he eats and drinks. He's in a good mood. Notice where he's lying down. Go and lie down there. Uncover his feet. "He will tell you what to do." I don't like this at all, Naomi. This is not good advice. I would like to tell you that this is not what it sounds like, but it is totally what it sounds like. Why did we pick this passage for HSM Takeover Day? Oh my goodness. No. That's okay. They're in next service. That'll be fine. We'll just close it there. Is it hot in here? Honest to goodness, if you look at like the original language, if you read commentaries on this, some commentary writers are like, oh, you know, she's trusting God and that he's going to protect her, which is like a total cop-out. Like, this is obviously, like, there's connotation here. She is telling Ruth to go in there and seduce Boaz. This is right there in the Bible. You did not realize you were to come to church and hear the word seduce, did you? But it's there. It is not me making it up. It's there. Just go in, find him, lay down next to him, and he will tell you what to do. This is honestly, all jokes aside, bad advice. And the crazy thing is, like, when Ruth aligned herself with Naomi, she says, where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. So she is positioning herself alongside but under Naomi and under Naomi's understanding of faith and under Naomi's leadership. And this whole thing started because Naomi is like, I am going to see to it you are taken care of. Naomi is taking a leadership stance in this relationship, and she is leading badly. Like, we can just be honest. Let's rip the Band-Aid. She is leading badly. She is failing Ruth. This is not good advice. Absolutely not good advice. And she's like the spiritual leader of this household. And what's fascinating is that we have so many people who come to church, you know, not just this church, but all the churches across the country and all over the world, when so many people have been hurt by spiritual leaders like this one. Like, let's say Ruth follows, she doesn't end up following the advice, but let's say she follows this advice. And let's say she does, you know, that does work out as Naomi's plan says. And then that's not a very healthy start to their relationship. So really what you have is Naomi, who should know better, who is the spiritual leader of this home, who is the one who's walked with God for longer, and she is leading badly. And I honestly, if I took one of these microphones and I went around the room and I said, someone who you've admired or looked to as a spiritual leader and they've led badly, they've given you bad advice, they have said they were someone and not been that person. They said they were loving and they were not loving. They said they were not judgmental and they ended up being judgmental. I'd probably get lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of stories of people who have been let down by spiritual leaders. People have been let down. People have been failed. People who have been led by someone and hurt by that someone. And honestly, if you look at the Bible, like, so often the spiritual leaders, the people who this whole thing is founded on, they failed. They dropped a ball. Abraham failed to trust God. Aaron, the high priest, felt the peer pressure. Moses responded in anger instead of patience. Saul loved himself more than God. David betrayed Bathsheba, her husband, and his nation. Zechariah didn't trust God and would give him a child. Peter was angry and impulsive. Almost all of the New Testament is people who have been selfish or hurtful and causing division, and Paul writing to that church and saying, stop, stop the division, forgive one another. Galatians to solve legalism, Colossians to solve heresy, 2 Timothy to solve tension and succession, Philippians solve conflict between two church leaders, 1 and 2 Corinthians to solve a whole host of problems, Philemon a conflict between a servant and a landowner, Revelations 2 through 3, there are various churches that all of them are sort of failing the mission of God. And so the Bible is full of spiritual leaders who acted like anything but. And I bet if we went around the room, your lives have been marred by people who were not who they said they were. I imagine some of you being here today is all but a miracle because of the way you've experienced church and faith leaders and people not who they say they were, or people who failed, or people who were who they said they were, but then they fell out of faith. We're going to play a video here. It's like 2 minutes long. It's about someone who walked away from faith, but then walked away from the church and walked away from leaders, and how this person found their way back. Her name is Jackie Hill Perry.
So when speaking with people that have dealing with church hurt, or those groups of people that have been hurt by a local church or members of a local church, I've dealt with it myself. When I came out of the church I was at for about 2 years, I was discipled in the church, etc. I refused to join a church for a good year. I was just like, I don't trust leaders. I feel like everything they say to me is a lie. I barely trust Christians because I feel like they're just always gonna put their convictions and their opinions on me. And if I don't walk like they do, then I'm not godly, and et cetera. But I linked up with a pastor in St. Louis who walked me through Ephesians and just was showing me, like, the purpose of the church, why it's here, why it's necessary, and even God's heart for the church. And I think one of the biggest motivating factors that helped me love the church again was seeing that Jesus loves the church. Seeing that Jesus calls his church his bride. Like, what personal language to use, you know, for a group of people. So, and even how I need the church, how in Ephesians where it says, like, he said about prophets and evangelists and all these people to grow us up to maturity. It's like, man, how can I ask God, make me like you, but I refuse to put myself in the context in which he uses to make me like him. Where it's like, man, like these prophets or teachers or pastors, their function is in a local body, and that is how I get mature. So if I love Jesus and I want to look like him, I need to put myself in the situation to grow. How do I walk out love if I'm not in situations where I'm challenged to love or hate, you know? And I think even on the forgiveness factor, I think God, this is an opinion, but I think God cares for us, desires for us to be healed, but I think he cares more about his glory. And that's hard to say, but I mean, like, I think some people that have been hurt use their pain as justification for hatred, which isn't right. Jesus was hurt. Isaiah 53 tells us he was hurt. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was disrespected, but he chose to love us and still chooses to love us. So I think that's our challenge as believers who have been hurt, is I choose to love the church of God despite their flaws, because Jesus loves me. Yeah.
What I love about that is it's someone who has been hurt by church and church leaders, and along the way they've made the long road back to love, made the long road back to forgiveness, and not allowing a perfect God to be marked by imperfect people, because all people are imperfect. Every church leader ever is just that, a person. And the best of men are men at best. The best of women are women at best. The best of church leaders are people at best. If I've never failed you, just wait. It's inevitable. I will. Like, I am who I say I am. And by that I mean I love God, I love my family, I love you all, and I'm selfish and deeply flawed and impatient, and I lose sight of individual people for the big picture. Like, I am who I say I am. I love Jesus, and I'm deeply flawed, and I haven't failed you yet. Wait for it. Eventually I will. If you've been hurt by someone in the church, a leader or someone who you felt judged you, I would ask you to think about that, not as a whole organization, or not to base your view of God on his people, because his people are just that, they're people. But as we approach this relationship together, if you are imperfect and I'm imperfect and we're imperfect and Kelly's imperfect and the elders are imperfect and the rest of the staff is imperfect, you know, what I would ask you to do is, as we try and experience God's love and love you with that love, and you experience God's love and try to love us with that love, like, let us carry that love into this relationship. You know, the First Peter says this. It says, most important of all, continue to show deep love for each other, for love covers a multitude of sins. And if I experience God's love and I offer that love to you, and you experience God's love and you offer that love to me, and when I fail you, not if, and when you fail me, not if, we will see that love that we have for one another, and we'll look past the hurts. We'll look past the failings. We'll look past the imperfections. I'm sure in a room like this, people, I've been here now for almost a year. Like, I've hurt some of you. I've probably failed some of you. I've discouraged some of you. I've said I'd call and I didn't. I'm imperfect. I would just ask you to look back at your previous, if you've been hurt by someone in the church, look back at them with this lens, and allow us to move forward and look back with this lens as well. You see, Ruth got this advice from Naomi, and as you're about to see, she doesn't follow the advice. But after she doesn't follow the advice, there's no, like, conflict. There's no tension. There's no point in the rest of the passage is there anything but love and acceptance and joy together between Naomi and Ruth. Even though Ruth doesn't follow his advice, because you can tell she thinks it's bad advice, but she, because there's love, she feels like the love covers over a multitude of imperfections. So with that, let's keep reading. So Ruth says this in verse 5. I will do everything you say, Ruth replies. She doesn't, by the way. Whew! So she went down to the threshing floor that night and followed the instructions of her mother-in-law. After Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he lay down at the far end of the pile of grain and went to sleep, because he was protecting it so that thieves couldn't steal it from him. Then Ruth came quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. So far, it sounds like the previous advice, but it's not. Trust me, it's not. Around midnight, Boaz suddenly woke up and turned over. He was surprised to find a woman lying at his feet. As you are, that makes sense. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she replied. "Spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer." You see, Naomi gave his advice to like commodify herself, to manipulate, to kind of paint Boaz into this corner of like manipulating him. I believe the phrase is gold digger. I think that's the term for what Naomi wanted to happen there. And she wanted her to commodify herself in that way. But what Ruth actually does is far more powerful. Like, she takes her power back. Like, she's not going to be commodified. Her only weapon isn't her sexuality. Like, she is a strong woman. Like, she takes this opportunity, and she proposes to Boaz. This is a marriage proposal in their terms. And we're not going to go into the details of it because we're going to get all into the weeds of their culture. But in this moment, when she was advised to go and seduce him, she proposes to him. She doesn't want to spend tonight with him. She wants to spend the rest of their lives together. The thing is, like, we think of proposals, and we think of probably something like this, right? This picture here. Like, this is what we think of when we think of proposal. This is what we, you know, this is like the cultural expectation of proposals. And we even probably have experienced or seen, like, odd proposals in the past. Like, someone proposing from underwater. That's super try hard and extra. I don't know why they would go to that level. Can we just agree that the halftime proposal should go away? Like, it's not cool. It's not romantic. It puts the person being proposed to in an awkward situation. Like, they kind of have to say yes. Like, these should just go away forever. This next picture is actually where I proposed to my wife. This is a canal in downtown Indianapolis. And right around here is where I proposed. And it was actually we had our first official date on this sort of like canal, this walkway in downtown Indy. And then 5-ish years later, this is where I proposed. Apparently, I said something in the prayer that gave it away. She knew I was going to propose, right? But I don't remember what I said, but she was like, "Oh, he's going to propose tonight? All right. Like, let's go. It's go time." I don't remember how I gave it away, my card face, my poker face, I let it go. But apparently during dinner, prayer before the dinner, before I proposed, she's like, "Oh, it's go time. Nice." Right? So then we ate at this spaghetti place, and then we walked around downtown, and then I proposed at the same spot of our first date. Like, that's like a normal proposal, right? There's like some thought goes into it. I have one friend who like did a hot air balloon ride and a horseback ride and like an outdoor like catered. Like, come on, dude, you're putting way too much pressure on the rest of us. Cut it out. Either balloon or horseback, not both. It's not fair to the rest of us. He's one of those guys who just has to ruin it for the rest of us. Anyway, it only takes one to ruin a friendship. But like, these are like normal proposals. But for Ruth, like, think about it from like this, her perspective. She had nothing, and he had a lot. She had been married before to Mahlon. We don't know how long. Sometime less than 10 years. When she was married, she couldn't have children. So we have no record of Boaz being married. All of our evidence says the contrary. He had probably just focused on his job and his fields and his farm. But when she was married, she didn't have kids, which would have taken her down a peg in their culture. Like, if you can't have kids, then like the blame always went to the woman, and it was unfair. And so that would have been like, oh, maybe this is not someone you want to marry. She had no social status. In that situation, in that culture, like, you would marry to, like, you know, cement or to raise your cultural status, and she had none. She was literally a beggar, and she was a Moabite. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we said in Deuteronomy 23 that you were, like, strictly forbidden from marrying Moabites, but yet over and over and over again in the book of Ruth, it lists her as a Moabite. It's like making a point to say it over and over and over again in 1:4, 1:22, 2:2, 2:6, 2:21, 4:5, and 4:10. It says, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite, Ruth the Moabite. So she's this person who is a Moabite. And she's the one who has the past, who's been married, who doesn't have kids, who has nothing, who brings nothing to the table, and she's the one proposing. You're like, man, that is an out-of-the-box proposal. That is an unexpected proposal. Like, she's the one who moves the needle. She's the one who advances the relationship. But look at what his response is. It says it in verse 10. It says this, "The Lord bless you, my daughter," Boaz exclaimed. "You're showing even more chesed now than you did before. For you have not gone after younger man, whether rich or poor. Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary. for everyone in town knows that you are a virtuous woman. Side note, this is not part of the sermon or whatever, but virtuous woman there is this phrase, eshet shayil, which is the same phrase used in Proverbs 31, which talks about like the ideal woman. Like, this is the only person in the Bible that phrase is ever used about. Additional side note, the author, I'm getting ahead of myself because this is next week's stuff, but the author of Proverbs is Ruth's great-great-great-grandson. So it's this cool kind of like family connection and how he remembers how he hears the stories of his great-great-great-grandmother. What's fascinating about this is his response to her. He's like, oh my goodness. He's blown away. He's thankful. And he bases it not on what she brings to the table or like, you know, financial resources or what she has. But he says, but you are this eshet shayil. You are this virtuous woman. He says, of course I will love you. Of course I will marry you. Thank you so much for taking this step. It's so kind of you, so generous of you. I will take it from here. I will step up. I'll be the man now. I will take it from here. And this is what we're talking about next week. But what's so fascinating about this, what I love about this story, is it's not just a good story. It's not just a romantic story. It's a God story. It's a gospel story. Because Ruth, when she approaches Boaz and says, will you marry me? She has nothing to offer him in return. And he says, yes, I will let's spend the rest of our lives together. You bring nothing, and that is fine because of who I am and who you are. And I say it's not just a romantic story or a good story, but it's a God story and a gospel story because that's the story of the gospel. That is my story. If you've walked with God, that is your story. When we first experience God, it is under his protection and under his provision, and because he is good and he is kind and he is loving, he has showed his said to us. And in response to experiencing God, we say, God, I want to spend the rest of my life with you. But you know what, God? I bring nothing to the table. I have nothing to offer you. And I thought about having someone come up here and like share their story and having this person's story be dramatic. You know, this person's like, I was an addict, or I was this, or I was abusive, or I was that, I was angry, I was a monster, but then I approached God with nothing, and he accepted me for as I am. But then I thought, yeah, this, that would be powerful, and there wouldn't be a dry eye in the place, but I don't want people to think that it's just, you know, people with addiction past or whatever who approach God with nothing, because it's all of us, every single one of us who have approached God and said, God, take me as I am, have approached him with nothing and said, I want to spend the rest of my life with you, but I have nothing to offer in return. And God says, that's exactly what I've been waiting for. And so this isn't just a good story or a romantic story. It's a God gospel story. You know, Ephesians 2, 8, and 9 says it this way. God saved you by his grace when you believed. And you can't take credit for this. It is a gift from God. Salvation is not a reward for the good things we have done, so none of us can boast about it. What's so important about this is if you have someone who has walked with God, if you've placed your faith in Jesus, if you have given as much as you understand of yourself over to as much of God as you understand, and I think this good, romantic, but God gospel story should do two things. It should make you grateful for what God has done in your life. Like deeply to your soul grateful that God has taken you as you were and said, yes, you have nothing to offer. And that's exactly what I've been waiting for. Also, I think it's a cure for spiritual pride. Do you find yourself thinking you're better than anyone ever? Do you find yourself feeling like, yeah, I love my neighbor, but not that neighbor, because I'm better than that person? Is there a person that you feel like you are better than, that they don't measure up to your level of expectation for any reason whatsoever? Because if there's someone who doesn't meet your expectation from someone, then you've forgotten that when you approach God, you had nothing in your hands. Just as that person has approached and said nothing. Like earlier I was talking about like if spiritual leaders have failed you, and those people who have failed you approach God at some point with nothing in their hands. And maybe they lost sight of that, but we all approach God with the same thing, nothing. And he says, yes, I've been waiting for you. And lastly, I would say this. If you've never walked with God, if you've never given yourself over to him, you don't need to check a box. You don't need to clear a hurdle. There's no hoop you have to jump through. If there was any hurdle, any hoop, any box, I would have not been able to. I would have failed. I couldn't have approached God. This approaching him with nothing means that everyone can approach him. That's you. We had someone last night in Saturday night service. It's the last Saturday. There was like seven people here. And as I'm going, no, not really, I'm joking, I'm exaggerating. I heard a, there's eight. No, I'm just kidding. There was like 45 or something, I don't know. We had someone last night, as I was talking about this, and they're someone who has, I've talked to them before, they just felt like they had no chance, no hope with God. And they felt that way for most of their life because of the things they've done. And last night, as I'm talking about that, it felt more real than they had anything has ever felt real in their life. And so they are experiencing Jesus today after last night. And so if you've never walked with God, if you've never given yourself over to him, there's nothing you have to bring. You offer nothing to the equation. And God says, yep, that's how I wanted you. Let's go. Let's do life together. It's not just a romantic story, and it is. It's not just a good story, and it is a good story. It's a God story, and it's a gospel story. Let's pray. God, I'm so thankful that we have to bring nothing to the equation. We have to bring nothing to the table, because if there was anything we had to bring, we would fail. We would not measure up. We would not meet your expectations. We would not bring whatever it is. Like, there's nothing, there's no low bar, there's no hoop we could jump through that some of us wouldn't be excluded, not included. We would not qualify. And so on both ends of this, God, whether we've walked with you or not, God, if we've walked with you, and but when we first approached you, we brought nothing to the table. God, keep us humble. Remind us of who we were before, and that it is through you, only by you, and it is for you that we have come to faith. And God, if there are people here today who have never walked with you, who have never given themselves over to you, I mean, may today be the day. May they find someone, myself or someone else in the cafe. It's the cafe workers, to do business with you, to pray with you, to experience your love today. God, we thank you for this story, because it is a good story, and it is a romantic story, but it is a God story, and it is a gospel story. And you know what, God? It is my story. And so on a personal level, I thank you for it. We love you. In your name, amen.